Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Prairie Film Companion. This is episode 4.5. This is another special episode where I'm joined today by my fine guest, a dear friend of mine from childhood, actually. We can talk about that a bit, but this is my dear friend, Jacob. Jacob, hello. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. Trying to get on for a while, and you finally allowed me on.
Yeah, one fun little tidbit from my dear friend Jake here is he watched the first episode, loved it, and immediately messaged me, and he was so supportive. He was gushing. He was like, I'm so proud of you. I can't believe you're doing this. You're awesome. And it was just really nice to see that. But why I wanted to have him on is that he's very knowledgeable. He is extremely witty and smart.
No, I'm not.
And he loves cinema deeply, so he's very well spoken about it. But without further ado, we'll get into what the film is. So today we will be taking a look and a conversation at Hitchcock's The Birds.
The Birds.
A very famous, very classic film. I can't believe I actually haven't seen it until now. I just finished watching it with you here, so it'll be interesting to dive into this.
I remember watching this movie as a kid, and there are some scenes that you always kind of have in your head. I think when films are made in a certain way, a certain quality, those scenes really resonate with somebody, and they just go on forever. And starting seeing this film, it's fantastic.
Right. I remember even I'm just like watching it, when we just finished watching it here, you'd point those scenes out, and it's just like, oh, it's cool to be in the nostalgia of your moment for that second in that film. And you're saying, oh, I remember this as a kid. It's just cool because I pictured you as a kid watching it, and like, it being imprinted in your mind.
I watched a lot of old movies growing up.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Let's touch base on that. Like, why?
Okay, so I have a certain theory about this. Now that we have a lot of resources on what we can actually watch. Netflix, Amazon Prime, HBO Max, YouTube. Okay? So when we were kind of growing up, we didn't have access to that. We could go rent a movie, mm-hmm. but we didn't have those resources, money. We can only watch what was on TV.
Yeah.
And what that meant was, and we want to be entertained, we go flip on the channel, which means that we didn't get to choose the type of films we would watch. Hmm. So it allowed somebody like us who actually watch a film that we usually wouldn't choose at a movie rental studio. Mm. So I think that that kind of helped shape our knowledge and appreciation of films we wouldn't have watched before.
Yeah.
Because if you go into Netflix and they have these algorithms, and more companies are using algorithms. So they kind of tailor everything for what you already like.
Yeah.
But then when you don't see something you choose, it might open you up to something you wouldn't have seen. That's right. When you watch these kind of old films, a lot of these films are not being watched as much. It's by a younger audience.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So when new movies make a reference to an old scene, I can kind of recognize that scene, but I think a lot of people wouldn't know where that scene comes from and how older films kind of still to this day influence huge segments of modern cinema.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And actually, while you were saying that, it also brought to mind all of the surrounding like media and TV that kind of helped build that. Like, I mean, in my mind, a lot of those classic movies that are highly referenced are from like TV shows like The Simpsons, right? Yeah. And things like that. And so like that helped kind of, we had these like kind of champions of those films help that and move it beyond just like their own time and their own era and move it forward to us. Right?
I knew about The Godfather by watching The Simpsons.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Wow. I didn't watch The Godfather till probably 4 or 5 years ago. And many references.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And you kind of picture out the whole film.
That's
by
right.
All these kind of cultural affiliations with that movie. Yeah. And then it's the first time I've ever seen it. I was like, oh, that's a good movie.
That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. I had the same thing with The Shining, which it was I had like every, like the actually The Shining, the film itself, was kind of ruined for me because I just remember
the
all
ending,
of these.
Right? Yeah.
Not just that, but like you know all of the really iconic moments where he's like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, good and bad. But yeah, to your point about like the things that we have access to and like the things that we would watch, you're right. Not that we were forced to watch these things on TV, but we were exposed to something that would be different than what we would usually watch, like say a cartoon show or something like that. Yeah. And it was like, oh, hey, you know, there's value in this, what seems like a boring black and white film.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think I'm much like yourself. I love classic films. I would actually go seek them out at the library at a point right. because I wanted more of that world. But
yeah.
Anyways, let's kind of start dipping our toes into The Birds. So maybe let's just start generally. What were your thoughts and feelings about it watching it now, kind of the second time around, let's say, aside from the first time you've seen it as right. a child?
Okay, so as we started watching The Birds, it kind of reminds me of a few different films. Okay, first and foremost, I make the argument that this film is a family drama.
Nice.
Okay, so you have the main character kind of fall in love or see some romantic relationship with the female main character. And then they're introduced to a small town where the mother comes in and she's obviously kind of very overprotective of her son.
Yeah.
And then, so the birds don't even play into factor until a good portion into the film. And even then, it's a slow buildup of the tension of the character, of the birds. Okay, so I believe this film is actually a family drama with birds and horror elements put in that kind of represents the tensions of the family.
That's cool. Nice. Yeah, it's interesting because, like, I was just thinking about the whole film in its scope. And, like, you start off, what is the first shot we see? It's, like, Tippi Hedren walking through the city,
yeah.
right, to this bird shop. And obviously it kind of gets more rural and more hometowny as the film progresses. And it does kind of, yeah, again, when you think of the last shot, it's, as we talked about, it's a family going into a vehicle, right? What, it's kind of ragtag family, if you will.
What did you think when the two characters first meet?
That is Tippi Hedren and right. the other male actor.
Right. Character's name is Mitch Brenner.
Mitch Brenner, yes. Yeah. Melanie and Mitch. Oh, interesting. Melanie and Mitch. I don't know if there's anything there. But yeah, my first thought, you know, the thing I'd brought up, I always, in a lot of Hitchcock films, in this one in particular, just I always go to their wardrobe. I know, and I'm looking at it because it just, to me, it signifies a lot about their personality, where they're coming from, and even maybe where they're headed. So seeing Tippi walk into this pet shop, it's all very unique. It's very weird. Like, right. why is this, like, elegant, beautiful woman going into a pet shop? Right. She's not getting a pet, is she? She wouldn't have a pet. She doesn't have time for a pet. Right. Or she doesn't want a pet, right? Right. That's what my third shot was. Like, she was too good for where she was, but she was kind of, like, comfy, sauntering around. Like, you yeah. could tell, it kind of felt like she wanted a different element than from her own, like, high class lifestyle. Life, yeah. yeah. On Mitch's side, he seemed a little more grounded and earthly. I mean, from everything from, like, literally the cut of his suit to the color of it to the hat, to me, it just all spoke like kind of your everyday 60s man. It right. was very, like, I'm sharp, I'm clean, I'm a hard worker, maybe middle class, but...
She comes in with a fur coat.
Does she? I totally forgot that. Does she actually? I thought it was just black, like a black
high quality, power suit. Well, definitely high quality attire.
Yeah. But there's a distinction there. I feel like, yeah, okay. this higher class versus like the kind of middle class man.
Right.
What were your thoughts?
When I first started watching it, and so basically she walks into the store asking for a bird. And then when Mitch walks in, she pretends to be a worker and totally, Mitch just completely questions her and yeah. just exposes the lie that she's not actually a worker.
Right.
I found it almost like a romantic comedy. Opening scene, romantic comedy, socialite walks in, having fun, guy walks in, she likes him. Oh yeah, I'm right. a worker here. He questions her and he questions her a bunch about the birds, which she obviously doesn't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured it almost to me almost like a romantic comedy. There's a yeah. romantic tension. She falls in love, love at first sight, and then she starts pretending to be someone she's not.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, like, although the reference I'm about to bring up doesn't like really fit, it just has that similar element when in Aladdin, when Jasmine and Aladdin meet.
Yeah.
Right? Except maybe it's inversed. Oh no, sorry, she's royalty.
Yeah.
And he's this ragtag
she's
guy.
She's pretending
in the streets.
To be
That's right.
Something she's not. Poor.
That's right. Yeah. And so, yeah, that kind of interesting how that starts. These two worlds collide.
Yeah.
All that bullshit. But yeah, anyways. Yeah. So as they progress and we see them, it is an interesting. I like the point that you had brought up about the questioning, the questions that he asks. Yeah. What was your observation then?
So when it comes to the first time they meet, she's pretending to be someone she's not. He starts questioning her about birds, to the point where he knows that she's lying. And then when she does a question that she has to reveal, oh, no, I was just pretending. Why did you do this? And he already knew who she was. Yeah. But also the next time they meet as well, the next four times, all he really does is question her. And each time she kind of reveals something about herself. Like the second time was when she's attacked the first time by the seagull. And then she's at the pub, I think it was. The pub?
Yeah, I think so.
I think it was a pub. And then he's questioning, why are you here? Here to meet a friend. What's her name? Oh, Anne. And he's just always questioning her.
Yeah.
So that's what I find. He's always kind of teasing her a little bit.
And it's cool because, like, yeah, in that dynamic, it's weird because she kind of likes it. You know? Like, she kind of likes that, oh, this hardworking middle-class gentleman is questioning and, you know, and stripping layers away and getting to know me deeper, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And it is kind of... which maybe we can touch base on later about like looking and her own and perception and her being looked at and how she feels when that happens, right? I guess to put it simply, which is maybe a bigger theme in Hitchcock's work, is this perversity, right? Okay. This, the perversion of looking, the perversion of being looked at, like how you feel when that happens. And anyways, I get that sense when they interact. It's like, ooh, he can see me a different way, you know. Ooh. Yeah, he can get deep to like the heart of this polished surface, which I think her character, this polished immaculate woman, and then kind of subsequently how we kind of see that literally and figuratively unravel.
Yeah, you guys,
is important.
You're right. She was wearing black in the first scene.
Yeah,
but kind of like he kind of pushes back that kind of high-end socialite exterior to question what she's doing, what's her motives, and what she actually feels.
Yeah.
That's what I see every single time, at least for the first few times they actually to converse in the film.
Yeah. You had a brilliant observation when they're in that first scene, she's assuming this pet shop woman attitude. And he starts peeling away at who she actually is. And she lets the bird out in this frantic little moment, which, funny enough, is like obviously a big foreshadowing of what is to come. But these two women are trying to frantically catch the bird. He's super calm, super still. So I think it is interesting that the women are the ones who are, you know, reaching for this bird. Maybe there's a lot of symbolism there in like letting the bird out of the cage, trying to grab control. And again, there is something to be said about femininity as well.
There's a lot of, there's a lot of birds in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The first bird we see, the one that escaped that you mentioned, is blonde like her.
Yes.
That's the only bird that I remember of the whole film that matches a color motif like her.
Well, that is the first one.
Okay.
Because as you remember, in the next scene, when she goes to his apartment, oh, my light just cut out. Yeah, hold on. Let's pause for just a quick second. We'll keep rolling. I'm just going to put that on AC power.
I thought that would have lasted longer.
Oh. That was like... Is that battery powered?
It is, but when they're plugged in, it charges.
Hello? Oh. Okay. Okay.
But I do want you to say that point about the...
Okay.
Okay. But the blonde bird, blonde little birdie. Oops.
That's good.
Yeah, no, it's going really well.
I feel a little tense, but I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. No, you feel actually quite natural at it.
No, I feel a little tense. Well, I know I'm tense, but that's okay. I'm doing my best. It's okay, though. Were you tense the first time? I feel okay?
I can't remember. I think there's just too many, like, these things, too many little...
Okay.
Practical things going yeah. on that I just kind of was like, eh, fuck it. Let's just talk and like make it work.
Wow, this thing keeps dipping. There we go. All right, good to go.
Good to go.
Cool. Just so that I have a mark. Okay, yes. Continuing the point about the first scene, the bird that escaped, its relation to femininity. Yeah, you made an interesting observation there that the blonde of the bird correlates with her hair, her personality. And when Mitch grabs it with his hat and then puts it back into the cage, there's a lot of interesting play. He even says...
Well, he says her real name. That's when he reveals who she actually is. Right,
that is true. Yes,
back to your point about femininity, what did you mean by that?
Well, I think I'm trying to touch on maybe the larger theme I'm seeing being woven in the film. Okay. In that, you know, Hitchcock's very known for what you can call psychological horror, thriller even. But in that same vein... A lot of horror and films use femininity as a point of transgression. That is that, oh, let's take this very beautiful, immaculate, polished, perfect being, the woman, you know, right. as an ideal.
Right.
And the real horror comes from transgressing upon her. Sometimes it can be like the real horror comes from within her, right?
Okay.
Her body is this... wild, weird thing. And I'm not talking about this film in particular, but
you mean when it comes to young female characters in horror films, do you mean a loss of innocence?
That's
like,
part of it.
Like sexual innocence, or just like they're exposed to the world and now it's time for them to reach from young to adult.
Yeah.
That's innocence.
I think in this film, as it comes across, I feel it's a mix of both.
Okay.
In that there are some hints of sexuality where it's like, oh, this is, you know, we get like these very young students, these elementary students who are preteens.
Yeah.
And this wave of birds is attacking them as well. Yeah. But the first person in the film that we see attacked is Tippi Hedren's character, or Melanie.
Right.
And so there is this connection about like, oh, then maybe this transgression against this young, again, maybe there's this quality about her that is still young and innocent.
Okay.
Beneath this demeanor, beneath all of this polished womanhood,
okay.
there is still something that, you know, in the context of the film, mm-hmm. is worth transgressing against.
Yeah, the thing I like about Hitchcock is that he uses a lot of different layers of film storytelling to see, like you said, different storylines. Mm-hmm. What I like about it is two qualities. One, like I said before, I think it's a family drama. Right, so we have all that tension of the mother and the son. There's only one daughter, there's no father, and the mother obviously misses the deceased father. The other thing, which you do see a lot when you watch the film, when she enters in the small town, and small towns are a gigantic motif in a lot of horror films. Mm. And really, it's small towns, the nice thing about them is they're small, secretive, and everybody knows each other. So when there's an intruder, kind of like an intruder, everyone knows what that is.
Yeah.
And when you notice that when she comes into the town and rents a boat and goes into the pub, it's kind of in the background, so I didn't really notice it the first time. Everyone's staring at her.
That's true.
Everyone knows instant. She's not from here.
Yeah, and it's almost, you know what's crazy? I just noticed this. All of the people staring at her, there's this beautiful synchronicity to it. You know, you watch her come in and she's this focal point and everything, and every air, you know, she sticks out. She's this elegant thing in this hometown. So of course everyone's going to watch her. But what I just noticed is that look, that kind of everyone, the crowd following her mimics birds.
Oh yeah.
Right? It mimics like birds, like when they see something go by, the kind of classic image is that all of them swoon together and look.
Right.
It's a flock of birds looking like this. And I think that kind of ties into later on when we get this like psychological philosophical spiel about, oh, you know, nature has been transgressed on by man, and man that makes the world unlivable.
I think that's a good point. When you talk about transgression, things being out of what their natural state should be. Like, things are naturally in the way they're supposed to be. When something comes in and moves it out of alignment, that's when nature reacts.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I think is kind of happening here. That's where the transgression comes from. Someone comes in multiple areas. Someone comes into a town where she doesn't belong and everyone notices her. Yeah. All the heads move in sync like birds. Also, I'll make this comment early. I believe the mother is the actual victim of the film. She goes through the most emotional turbulence. So it's her life that's kind of being uprooted from the natural order of things. She has her son who takes care of her and his sister, her daughter. And then some woman comes in and is essentially trying to take him away, and kind of nature reacts. The whole system is out of alignment. So when the system is out of alignment, things start to happen.
That's a good, that is a very interesting way to frame it. Because you think about who Melanie is. Right. She's just this single, well-to-do, wealthy, polished woman, right? No mention of kids, no mention of really family.
No responsibility.
No, none really. It's kind of like
she goes on the whim. She meets some guy. I'm going to go right to his house.
Exactly. We talked about that. Let's stay there for a second. We talked about kind of the seeming ease and frivolity of how accessible this little town was to this like polished woman. And part of it is, okay, she's a very beautiful blonde woman. If you're a very beautiful blonde woman in any part of the woman, in any part of the world, you're going to get by just fine, right? Like you're going to get doors open for
you. And looks matter in life. They're not everything you can overcome.
That's right.
But it's helpful. And yes. I would rather not be ugly in this world than, right? If I had to choose, right? But
well, too bad because you kind of got the shit in.
Well, you know. No, I'm just kidding. Like, but there's something I'm not sure about, because this film was made in 1963. So it could also be that people were more trustworthy back then in general.
Yeah.
So maybe when that's pointed out, it's not a big deal to the audience back then. So basically what happens is, if somebody hasn't seen the film, is that she meets Mitch, which she falls in love with the first time they meet. He calls her out on her, you know, her lies. So she decides to follow him. And she easily finds out exactly her house, his house, what town, which house, pointed to. And she says to one of the patrons of the town, "I want to come through the back." He's like, "Oh, okay. Sounds good.
Let me show you how."
And then it comes to the point where, like, okay, is this the horror? Where's the birds? Like,
yeah,
she's being the one kind of stalkish.
That's right. Yes,
stalkish.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because Hitchcock loves doing that.
Yeah.
Loves making you love the transgression, or at least loves making you enjoy watching it. Right.
Right.
Again, we see that when she finally has broken into the house, snuck away. And then we get this little moment where she's like, she moves away from the dock just a bit, maybe enough not to be noticed, and then stays in the watches.
Right. Let's not. So what did she put in the house? Let's not forget that.
Yeah, of course. That's right. She takes the birds, which are the same color as her dress. This canary red. canary green, with a hint of red on the beak. But she's driven again. This very frivolous kind of move. Hey, let's leave San Francisco, drive up to this little town about an hour and a half away, drop off these caged birds for this random man I ran into at the pet shop, and see where this goes. You know?
I think that does demonstrate a quality, like you mentioned, that she is high-end. She comes from a rich background. She doesn't have a care in the world.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing really holding her back from just going to a town and just being there for a weekend.
Yeah.
Or a week. Because she does.
That's true.
Just like, okay, let's just stay here and chill.
Yeah.
With some guy I don't know.
Exactly.
Basically.
Yeah. She can afford to.
Who basically insulted me the first time we met.
Yeah.
And the second time. And just
questioned.
Yeah. She obviously is attracted to that quality.
That's right.
In my opinion.
No, she is. There's this joy that comes across when she's being questioned. She's being hammered. Although, later on, when they get to the scene of the vehicle, when she's about to drive away, she's kind of a little angered. Mitch keeps kind of pressing for, like, why, what her motive is and why she's there. And then he brings up the whole Rome incident of this scandalous report of her being, like, naked in a fountain and la, la, la. And so,
well, that's the time in the film where she actually has to kind of be held responsible for that.
Yeah.
Finally, it's like, okay, this what happened. Explain yourself.
That's right.
And she does.
And when she does, but she doesn't like it. And it's very uncomfortable. Yeah. And she's like, oh, well, yeah. What if that's what happened? Then, you know, so what? And it's kind of this defensive posturing of this like frivolous life.
So but, that goes back to the first scene. So she's pretending to be a worker. He questions her. She finally admits, no, I'm just pretending.
Right.
And that's what happens in that scene, mm-hmm. that she has to finally just admit what she is.
Right,
yeah. She's like, I'm a socialite, so what if I did? Were you naked? No, I wasn't. That's just tabloids.
Yeah.
But you did go in swimming. I was pushed in. But then like the truth comes out. He questions each time. It's like, finally, just explain yourself. That's right. What she does. And I think that's one of the qualities that she finds very attractive about Mitch.
That he can like unleash the honesty in her, right? Yeah, or access that.
He's gonna get out of her.
Right.
It's question. And he does that about 4 times. And she comes back every time.
That's true.
So she's liking it.
Yeah.
She's liking it.
I mean, yeah, I love that discussion. I kind of wanted to come back to the mother and woman out of touch sort of conversation, because that was, again, kind of what I feel is central to this idea of how this film is depicting femininity and where the horror comes into that. Okay. You know, again, that's not like fully... I'm mature in my mind, but I can't help but pick at those threads because it feels like that's what's being communicated. But I think everything we've talked about her, like her frivolous life, the, you know, I'll go spend a weekend up in this random place with this random man. It all speaks to this woman out of line, right? She's not a mother. She doesn't have responsibilities. And if you think about the mothers in the film, not only Mitch's own mother, who already has this very kind of strong connection with her son, and a lot of the women surrounding that would be interested in the son are jealous of it in some way, or come across it and it's like, oh, this is a point of contention. The other mother that you said, this was a little more pointed to your comment about nature being out of order, right?
Yeah,
out of sorts.
That's a common horror motif,
right? And this is like the nature of woman kind of being out of order. Because if you fast forward to the end when we're into one of the waves of the sea, I think it's Crow's attacks at that point. Okay. It's in the diner. We've had this big discussion, again, the philosophy of man versus nature and all of that. And then a mother with her children eating there are getting a little distraught. Well, really the mother is.
Right.
And she's very like viscerally kind of affected by all of this. And then
I just wanted to point out that scene, I can see the influence that scene has in so many modern horror films. So you have a small town and you have the town village folk in one area with the outsider, and they're explaining why the horror is happening in these birds, or like why is a mist happening, or why is this happening. And they're forced into a building and they start communicating what they actually believe. And you have kind of like the old woman who's been there a long time, who knows the history of the town. Because in that scene, there's an old woman who starts to smoke, and she's an expert on birds.
Yeah.
Somebody walks in, just an expert on birds, right?
Yeah.
So you have that common theme in horror films where when that happens, there's an old character who knows the history of the town and can kind of explain what's going on.
Right.
And not that she does, but it does have that vibe to it. Like somebody who knows what's going on. And then she says, well, something's out of alignment. Birds don't do that.
That's true, yeah.
And he's kind of explaining that.
Right.
So that's just an interesting scene that I see. It's common in horror films.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a super good point. Like, yeah, obviously it resonates beyond just the film itself. Yeah, and I think the last thing I just wanted to note about that scene was the mother who's getting affected by the conversation and the potential of these birds attacking, you know, I think, after the birds have actually attacked and erupted and there's a return to the diner, that the mother is the one who kind of comes and addresses or accosts Melanie.
Right.
You know, she's the one that says, like, no, there's something wrong with you. There's something evil about you.
Yeah, exactly. So I like that scene too, because as we stated before, when there's a small town, a lot of movies have small towns, very secretive, natural order things, something or someone comes in and takes things out of alignment. That's what's happening in that scene. They blame an outsider for all the freakish events that are happening. And it only happened, it was a coincidence or not a coincidence that it happened with the invader.
Right. Yeah.
And I think this has kind of that invasion trope where an outsider comes in and attacks happen.
Yeah, definitely. But what's beautiful about it is that it's done in the subtle, perfect, yes, sumptuous, smart, you know, impatient way that really only Hitchcock could do.
Okay, so in every instance where you find out she's a socialite, she doesn't have really a care of the world, she talks with her rich daddy, all that, this is brilliant. There's no exposition. Like, right, a film will just be kind of started off and then just say, oh, look, it's Miss Whoever from this rich background. And it's kind of this really get it out of the way, explain who she is, done.
Yeah.
It's explained who she is throughout the scope of the film.
Yeah.
Right? There's no exposition saying, hi, rich lady, come by the store. It's just, you get those hints of what she is, where she came from, her background throughout the film. And it's not in your face boring. It's just explained throughout the film.
That's true.
And that's brilliant. There's no scene. In Rear Window, the opening scene explains everything that happened.
Right.
With no dialogue.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what Alfred Hitchcock does brilliantly.
Yeah, definitely. And it brings you along as,
yeah,
this like excited passenger, yes, right? Like you're curious about the person because you're watching them go through these kind of odd and unique events and you don't know their history.
Right.
But as you slowly start to get these tidbits of their life, it's not only like, okay, that's a fact of her, it resonates with what's happening. And again, it just all speaks to this brilliant craftsmanship of you know, Hitchcock wanting to keep you there, wanting to keep you excited about what's happening, but not like in her perspective or any one character's perspective, but just like you're this, again, kind of passenger on this really fun, interesting ride. It's a little scary at times. It's a little interesting. It's a little naughty sometimes too. Right. You know, you shouldn't be breaking into people's houses, but let's watch what happens when you do.
Explain how, after she breaks into the house and leaves the lovebirds, and she kind of moves away on the boat. Mm-hmm. Explain what you meant by the scenery of that. How you're seeing her from her vantage point.
Yeah. I'm gonna draw it up here just so I can kind of visually cue it up as I go. But one thing I super respect about Hitchcock is all of the visual language. To me, being behind a camera, liking to do more cinematography work, I always look for the language of the film. That is, what the shots and how they're moving and how they're constructed are saying about the scene and this person. One thing I note about her and how the camera moves in relation to her is that it is very soft and elegant. It's very poised. I remember as we were watching, I brought up that there's these tracking shots that is like a very steady following, right? As she's going onto the pier and into the house, it's all just a very steady tracking shot that is like meant to be this, like, to not only draw you into the moment, but to also signify kind of her elegance, you know? It's like this thing floating behind her and walking. Okay. And so we're from her perspective because we're seeing her a bit, but we're also watching her, right? So we're not like in her eyes. We're not in her mind, in her perspective. We're watching her. It's kind of cool. Again, like somehow Hitchcock can position us with her shots and his choices to be like a spectator in this moment, right? Of course, every film does that. But here it's like, oh, but you feel that slight guilt of, oh, I shouldn't be in this house right now.
You know? Yeah, you see a lot of camera work in that scene is from her vantage point.
Right.
So like you're kind of going, like you said, you're going on the journey with her. Like you shouldn't be here. You're always on the lookout.
Yes.
So when the camera moves out of her, away from her and to her vantage point, that's kind of like the audience is on the lookout with her.
Yes, definitely.
That's kind of how I get. So that's how you get that tension. It's like always see somebody coming in, is somebody about to catch us.
Right.
And then you kind of sneak out with her. And I like the fact that those tracking shots, I think that it builds tension that, since it's slow, there's a higher risk of getting caught.
Yeah, it feels
like,
that way.
Like if you skip scenes and just skip from her leaving the door to the boat, that distance, the timing's gone. But by having that longer extension, there's a higher risk in the feeling of, oh, she might get caught at any time. Because yeah. you're on the journey, like, hurry up, hurry up.
Right.
That's what yeah. I, that's what that, the vibe I get from that scene.
Yeah. And again, like, why is it important to make you feel naughty in this way? You know, that you're looking upon something that you shouldn't really be.
It's entertaining.
It is. And it's, I think, you know, Hitchcock understands that. It's like, that's almost at like the core of us watching a film, of us looking, you know, this insight beyond our current day that's like, ooh, we shouldn't be even watching what's happening, but it's so curious to not look away.
See, right? I think it's brilliant. So throughout the movie, I don't think there's many scenes where you see it from the perspective of a specific character.
Right.
That whole sequence where she sneaks in, there's several of them. When yeah. she looks out the window, you don't just see her looking out the window. You see out the window itself.
Yeah.
And then when she's looking out the door, you see out the door. So that's what it does. It allows the audience to actually see what she's looking at, on the lookout with her. And you mentioned that there's just no soundtrack.
Right.
And that scene, it's all very quiet.
Yeah. The whole film is a remarkable feat of no music, no soundtrack.
I didn't realize that. When I first watching it, I didn't realize there was no soundtrack.
Insane. And it is like very tense, very dramatic almost, right, without the use of what we commonly know as, like, you know, strings just being tightly taut and, you know, going before the scare. And
this is also with Alfred Hitchcock, you know, he knows how to use sound.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
You know, he's an expert in how to use music, timing, intensity, type of instruments being used to make an image or a scene much more intense. He That's purposely right. does not use sound.
Which is incredible. I mean,
yeah, he knows what he's doing.
In his previous films and many to come, his composer, Bernard Herrmann, is probably one of the world's best film composers to ever grace a screen and the soundtrack in our ears. You know, he gave us the classic Psycho right. score.
Yeah.
You know, and like the amazing what it does to you. He gave us North by Northwest and Vertigo and all of the wild soundtracks that those are, beautiful in their own right. And here, nothing. None of that.
Okay,
right?
So there's this scene in Jaws when they're tracking the shark. And then I forget the character's name. The person's hired to actually hunt the shark. Not the sheriff, not the scientist, the other character.
Okay.
The scene is they finally put this big hook on the shark. And the shark, and you see him, the camera's focused on him, and you see him say, he's got under the boat.
Mm.
He's got under the boat. And there's no sound to it. And you just see the line, and you don't see the shark, and the line's being pulled. And you know something's building up to something. Again, no sound.
Yeah.
So I think when you know how to do it with little sound, it builds that atmosphere of a fear.
Yeah.
Like something's about to happen. Something's gonna happen, and she can get caught at any point. But yeah, it's brilliant usage of no sound.
Yeah, like what we had said while we were watching it is that, you know, it seems like in my mind, it seemed like, oh, it would be tougher to execute that, right? If you were given that task to make a horror film without music, yeah, you'd have to be really good at it, you know, right, what you're doing. And just again, back to the craftsmanship of Hitchcock and how the scenes are constructed and devised. Going back to your thought about the no score, and then when we're in her perspective sneaking into the house, I realized that that's a tool that is actually matured in the duration of the film. That is, that Hitchcock comes back to it with greater effect because it's been built, it's been earned, and where you feel that the most present is in the final scene of the house when they've boarded everything up and the birds start to come through. They've kind of had that wave come through and it's nighttime and everyone's falling asleep, and then Tippi grabs the lamp to go up to the stairs because she heard some birds flapping.
Okay.
And in that scene, we get some more perspective from her. She's walking towards the stairs, just yes, the flashlight showing, and it's that super haunting image of like, just the one light source being the flashlight, lighting up this staircase going up. Yeah, honestly, as I was watching it, it kind of reminded me of The Exorcist. I was like, oh my God. But that's obviously a film that came much later. and just like that same sort of raw horror intention of this empty staircase at night with this looming thing that could be in the room.
Yeah.
You know, again, it kind of is used to much greater effect then, and it's changed now from us being like, ooh, this is fun and cute and interesting, to being, this is really horrifying.
Yeah,
right?
And okay, so for that scene, like you said, she uses a flashlight to kind of make her way up the stairs.
Yeah.
I think something that was difficult, more difficult perhaps, with Alfred Hitchcock, is that he made a horror film shot in almost entirely in light.
Good point.
In daylight.
Yeah.
Most horror films that I know of have seen take a lot of precedence at nighttime.
Yeah.
The whole film takes place in the day. The attack of the birds take place in the day. And that one scene at the end, when she's going up the stairs with a flashlight, I think it uses dramatic effect. Right. It's so different from the rest of the film.
That's right.
If you finally have, I don't want to say the word common, but a more darker, scarier, fearful element to it. Now you have dark. Now you have just a flashlight. You're going upstairs in the middle of the night.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's when those more horror elements come in. And when they do, since it didn't happen throughout the film, and that's when it has more quality to it. You can feel it more because it's finally happening in that scene.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You even made the same point about the sound and the birds, right, and the quiet moments versus the eruption of bird wing flatter and, you know, everything else. All I was going to say is that, you know, I couldn't help but think of other films or other attempts at something similar. And obviously there's not like tons that is as effective. I think one in recent history is probably Ari Aster's latest film, not Hereditary, but Midsommar.
Midsommar. Okay.
Yeah. There's a lot to go into that film, and I personally didn't like it too much.
I
think
like
there's
the film?
No, I think what like, actually to the point is that, you know, it kind of is sold as a horror in the sun, right?
Yeah.
Horrific thing.
You're right.
But to kind of, in a way, it's a bit cheapened. Okay. Because there isn't the same sort of intricacy and mastery in the story, the plot, the characters, the wardrobe, the sound, and the cinematography in that film, even compared to this. You know, there's a lot more tense moments in this compared to Midsommar. And yeah. I think what Midsommar's approach was just to be fucked up and weird.
Yeah, it was odd. The whole moment that film came in, it was odd from the beginning. The fact that it's almost always daylight is odd.
Yeah.
So I want to give that oddness to it, that weirdness to it, like you said, right?
Sure.
But I think so one thing about this film I noticed, unlike other Hitchcock films, is that it's very slow.
Yeah.
Long tracking shots. A lot of a lot of seeing where the character is going, right? So from the scene when she meets Mitch all the way to when she finally arrives at his house, it shows everything.
Yeah, it's that's a good point.
It doesn't skip or go from here to there. It explains she went to his apartment. He's not there. The neighbor just gives her the address, like very trustworthy. And then you see her drive. You're seeing her drive with the birds, and she goes to the town. And then she asked for him. You see that whole sequence. It's basically like you know exactly how she got there.
Right.
Very slow buildup.
Yeah.
Like slower, no sound. It's different.
That's a good point. Yeah, I kind of wanted to hop back. Not to my point. I didn't mean to bring up Midsommar at all in comparison. It's just the only other idea.
You mean the element that the fact that it's a horror film shot mostly in daylight.
Sure, yeah. But I guess why I wanted to bring that up was that kind of this time and this duration and again all these devices used to evoke this sense of looming fear and this ominous other world, I feel again is much more effective here. Part of that is what you were alluding to, this pacing, this you spend a certain amount of time here because when you do go to the more tense, scarier moments, they feel all the more, dripping with anticipation. Like when they're waiting for the birds to come.
Right.
And there's a lot of like shots of them just looking at the ceiling. And you see the ceiling. And then you're waiting. And then there's a movement. And then the mother puts away the coffee, and you're like, Oh, yeah, is she going to go put away the coffee? Everything.
Yeah, you don't know what she's about to do, and she just gets the tea and coffee and puts
it away. That's right. You're like, is something going to happen? Are there going to be birds bursting through right now? They have before. Is it going to happen again? So you have this sense of the duration that you did spend before in a scene of her going to Mitch's apartment, going to the countryside. Now it's being used against you, right?
Right.
And I think that in of itself is a Hitchcock trope of, oh, you're comfortable with this. I'm going to let you live in that. And then I'm going to make that uncomfortable, right? I think that all speaks to the part of how it can make an effective horror in daylight, so to speak.
Right.
I didn't have much more to add to that about.
No, because that. I think like the usage of night, or as you said, Midsommar. I thought Midsommar was a good movie, but it was a good movie. I liked it probably for the reasons you hated it. I liked the oddness to it. This cult-like feeling of kind of this strange little secluded group of people who have weird beliefs.
Sure.
And you know it's leading up to something.
Yeah.
You know it's leading up to something. But with the usage of night, using usage of odd beliefs and kind of cultish image, it can sometimes be used as a like a crutch in some films.
That's just right. Like, yeah. Okay, that's the best way to put it.
If we can't build intensity, let's just make it night.
That's right, yeah.
With this one, he doesn't use any of that. He doesn't use sound.
That's right.
He doesn't use creepy sound. He doesn't use creepy lighting other than the what scene you described to.
Yeah.
He slowly builds the tension of the birds in this film, essentially about a romantic relationship and a family drama.
Mm.
And it's slower paced, but there's great value to it. It's done well.
Yeah. No, that is extremely well put. That he's in a way throwing away the crutches that most horror or a thriller would embrace.
I almost think he did it as a challenge.
Definitely. Because it feels
like,
that way.
Like birds.
And you know what? It's like better than most other films ever made.
Because if you think about it, oh yeah, birds go crazy and just start pecking people.
Yeah.
Right? It's like okay. that's silly. That sounds silly. Oh, we're not gonna make any sound.
Yeah.
Okay, sure. And no night scenes. You're not allowed using darkness.
Right.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
And then he does a good job. It's like all the elements you need to make a horror film, like a quality villain.
Right.
Like a quality scary villain. Elements of the occult or something like that. And then using creepy sound. It's all gone. Those tools are gone. Make it scary. Build tension.
Yeah.
Make the horror. And he does.
Absolutely.
And it's like he challenged himself.
Yeah.
And now this is considered one of his top films.
As I was watching the film, I couldn't help but feel like, I'm not sure if you've seen a film called, I want to get this right. I don't know if it's Take Shelter.
No.
I believe it's called Take Shelter. It's with the guy who played Zod in one of the recent Supermans.
Oh, Michael Shannon?
Yes, Michael Shannon. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't seen Take Shelter.
Okay. I mean, in short, it's about... It has a similar ominous feeling. So yes, it's Take Shelter, 2011. And overall, it's about this man, Michael Shannon, who gets these like feelings and premonitions that something big is coming and that he needs to brace his family for it, and that little signs around the world and in the news are indicative of this thing to come, right? It's never really described. It's never understood what it is that's coming. Anyways, this kind of, again, hearkening to the conversation had in the diner later on in The Birds, the end of the world, you know, this cataclysmic event we can't see and we can't fully know, but is impending. And anyways, the feeling that you get in that film is like, is this man convincing this small town, to just like buckle down for no reason? Is there validity in what he's saying? Is this like a mental episode he's going through? And the whole journey of the film is about you exploring that.
Right.
Like, what is that, you know, anxiety and that tense, and like, is it real? Is it happening? And I think the film ends beautifully, not to like give you a solid answer, but to be like, there's this really wild, not mystical, but like intersection of our own physical temporal reality
okay.
and something more out there.
Is it like an existential horror film?
I guess you could call it that. Okay. Yeah. So anyways, that's actually a great word, because why I felt that was that it felt like the birds achieved that earlier on super well. Again, there's a lot of allusion to, Melanie, you're the one that's evil. You have brought this to this
town.
But how? You know, she's a woman. She's a well-to-do woman from the city in San Francisco. How is it that she brought this flock of killer birds, right? And but nonetheless, when you watch it, you're like, yeah, everything has kind of been happening as
she came in
deeper and got
the moment
more
she
involved.
Comes in. So like you discussed. So the scene where she goes into the house, you see from her vantage point, we're going to get caught. And then she starts to come back on the boat when Mitch sees her. What happens when she's coming back? That's the first attack from the seagull.
That's right. Whoa. That's a good point.
And it's brilliant because it's not like a bunch of seagulls. It's not intense. It's just a small little taste.
Yeah.
Of something happened. Here's your little punishment.
Yeah.
And as the movie progresses, and she was only going to stay for that day. He invites her to stay for the night. And you see more birds attack.
Right.
And the longer she stays, so you can almost see, is she the reason?
Right. Yeah.
Also, okay, so going back to you were discussing about that film, of how it slowly builds tension. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the movie The Invitation?
Yes. I watched it on your recommendation.
So that movie, there's always something odd. I won't give away the ending, but there's an oddness to it. And you don't know, is it because of the main character? So he's invited back to his ex-wife's house because she came back from a trip to Brazil. She was gone for 3 years. And he's invited back with a group of friends. And they did have a relationship. And they have a bad history. A tragic history. But so he has all these weird, odd feelings throughout the film. But the question is, you don't know whether it's just because of him and his depression, or is there something happening that's weird going on with everyone else?
Right.
And there's this muddiness that you don't really know. Mm-hmm. And it slowly builds up to that. And I think that's what you're saying. It's like this film does a good job of slowly building up the intensity. And you don't really know where it's coming from. Is it because of her? Like, I think it's a family drama. So I think it kind of represents the tension or the change in the family dynamic. So is it come from the family, from the mother? You don't really know where it comes from.
That's right. Yeah, and you're given like little hints and clues or maybe even like red herrings to think like, oh, that mother looks like really sinister and weird. You know, maybe it's like psycho-ish that the mother's behind it all or something like that. We even see a portrait of their father, that first portrait we see as Melanie's playing the piano and the young girl, Kathy.
Yeah.
Is it Kathy? She's talking to her. And they're talking about the father. And the father's head's like in the picture, that is, in the portrait, is just cut off.
Right.
Right. And then they're at the same moment talking about how a murder happened. And anyways, there's an implication. Oh, maybe because the father is cut off from this family, you know, things are awry. Things are unsettled.
Also, remember when they first meet, when the main character meets Kathy for the first time, what Kathy does for her.
Mm-hmm.
What does she do?
Brings her the birds.
Yeah, but Kathy, when she first meets that, she gives her a hug. Like, doesn't even know her, gives her a hug.
Right, yeah.
They have dinner, and when you're seeing is that she's already asking her to stay. Can you stay? I really like it if you stay. Do you have to leave?
Yeah.
Right? That, and I think when it comes to, like you said, the mother, she ain't liking that.
That's right.
And that's what I think you don't really know. Is it because she's an outsider, or is it the mother almost causing everything to happen because she hates the fact that this woman comes in and takes her son and now basically taking her daughter from her too. So that's what I get.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of what's cool is, like, I was just thinking about this, that there's a lot of cool little existential crises.
Yes.
Right? And they're very simple, of family, of relation to a member of the family. And I even just, couldn't help but think about like my own anxieties You know, I don't know how you feel. I mean, maybe you can speak a little better to this. You are a father. You have a family. It is a growing and new family, and there maybe are a lot of worries and anxieties with that. But what I feel this film crystallizes well is some of those anxieties and fears, right? Like, I personally am like, oh, you know, I'm 30 right now. Do I need a family right now? Am I behind the curve? Oh wait, no, I'm gonna be working, for myself. Right. I'm gonna be tippy. Hey, shoot, she's an independent woman, cool. But wait, I'm missing some part of me, you know? Oh, right. Wait, I have this desire to be a father at some point. Wait, oh, you know what I mean? Like, there's all these like little existential crises that we have regardless of where we are in our lives.
About family. Why did I do a bad job?
Yeah.
So when you talk about the existential crisis, that the mother her husband's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And she makes it plain, like, she does not want to be abandoned.
Yeah, she says it.
Worst fear, I don't want to be abandoned.
Yeah.
Right? So that's when you have that scene where you intensely focus on her face. Because she, you can see the anxiety in her as she's speaking it. So it's a real visceral feeling. And I think, yeah, that's what, so Mitch now has basically become that role. It's kind of like the father. Even when the way he talks, like, yes, dear. I found it kind of odd. Why would you call your mother dear and darling? And
yeah, you're right.
And it's not that it's bad to say that. It's like, I think this movie kind of does it on purpose.
Oh, of course. He's like,
dear and darling. And then he ends up calling, what's her name? Miss Daniels. Those same kind of affectionate terms.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then all of a sudden he comes in and starts calling her that. And like, oh, he's about to leave.
Right.
And going to take the daughter away too.
Yeah. That's a good point about the daughter. It's so funny because like all of the people that we see in the way they speak, in the way they carry themselves, they're very poised.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like they're very well held together. But as we progress through the film, we do see each one of them come apart in some way or unravel or even kind of die. Like Annie, she's like, we even talked about, wow, she's stunning. Like, she's quite a beautiful woman. She looks like Elizabeth Taylor. She has this like really gravelly, you know, gorgeous voice. She smokes, she's calm, she's confident. Oh, you want a drink? Oh, come in. It's been a long night. You know, like, it's very poised. She dies at the end of it. And I just wanted to say this about the one character, which I feel stands out above that. Is that where we see all of these others unraveling from their facades? The one character that is like super genuine, and which you pointed out is an amazing actress, is the young Kathy.
Oh yeah, she's a good actress.
She's not only an amazing actress, you see her and you're like, she is in genuine anguish, and she's expressing that so beautifully. You almost can't even tell if it's like she's been on set for too long and Hitchcock's pushing her, or if she's just somehow an amazing channeler of that set of emotions. And what I'm bringing to say there is that, you know, she is young and innocent, and she doesn't have all of these life hangups and experiences and existential crises. Right. So when everything is happening to her, it's very honest and pure.
Right.
Right. And we can see that in her face.
I like how you mentioned the point that as the movie progresses, each character unravels. And just loses. Okay. So you mentioned Anne, right? Anne?
Mm-hmm.
So she had a relationship with Mitch. Right. Some woman comes in at the very end. What happens to her at the end of the movie? How does she? What's her conclusion?
Anne. She dies on a set of stairs.
On a set of stairs. When it comes to the mother, she's hysterical. She goes off on Mitch. If your father was here, he would know what to do.
Right.
And she goes crazy. Like, she's lost everything. Even Mitch. So I think we discussed this. So in the scene where Anne finally is dead and her eyes are picked out, that's when you first see Mitch have an emotional reaction. Like, he has a crying.
Yes.
Like, he, tears point. Coming out. Yep. So again, you see like he did care about her. Right. And then that's lost. And you see him kind of break down. Like you said, he's very poised. He goes to a birthday party in the suit. He's pretty.
Yeah. He's I think you would do that.
Yeah. Well, if it looks good, it looks good.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, you can't blame me. It looks good.
No, that suit looks. I'm so jealous of all of his suits. I don't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay.
Looks fucking immaculate. But anyways, yes,
you should just get tailored suits. You should do the podcast. Thank you for dressing up for the podcast. Yeah. I appreciate we appreciate that as an audience.
For just the audio viewers, I'm just in sweats and a matching great shirt. I don't think I've changed my underwear or shirt since yesterday. So
what the audience doesn't know is your pants are digitally put in. You don't have pants on right now. That's weird. And then you're just like, oh, I'll just digitally put it in later. I'm like, okay.
I will at some point also show my exposed bare feet to the camera to carry the tradition of showing my gnarly feet. And hopefully they're not dirty.
Traditions are good. Yeah. It's good to keep them up.
But wait, I'm so sorry. I cut you off about, you had such a good point about him and his unraveling.
Right. So like you mentioned, he's well-dressed, quite a strong character. I think handsome. He has to be.
Look at that chin. Freaking. I feel like if you were to draw a 60s man, you know?
You would look like that.
That would look, yeah, that's what it would look like.
Yeah? Yeah, maybe. You kind of look like that. Spanish version. But he's well-dressed. Always wears a suit. He's a lawyer, well-spoken, strong, confident, especially to a socialite, a rich socialite. And he questions her. Who are you? Come on. Right? Gets down to who she is and makes her explain her mom, her relationships, all that. And the scene is when Anne dies and you see an emotional breakdown of the character. He doesn't break down.
No, but it's like the most emotion we've seen him release.
He's broken. Yeah, like you see a slight
something broken in
his character wall.
Yeah,
right. And then as the movie progresses, and the scene I think it's the whole sequence of them in the house, boarded up in the house. It's incredible. It's well done. And that's when he doesn't have his suit on. He doesn't have his suit
that's
on.
True.
Like nobody, and then nobody's really wearing what they're normally wearing. Yeah. Everyone's kind of broken at that point.
Right.
And then, okay, so I have this idea that when films are well made, and not just for the viewing audience, but like have a good scene that's always remembered, you can watch it as a kid. It's kind of going back to the point where I believe that we watched those films because they were on TV and that gave us exposure to films we wouldn't have watched before.
Right.
I think. Yeah. And that scene where in the end of the film where they're boarded up in the house and the birds are trying to break in, and he's trying to close it and boxing the bird out, you know, and his hands are bleeding. I remember that scene from decades ago.
Yeah.
From like scenes. Those scenes you just remember for a long, I remember that scene.
Yeah, that's nuts.
It's well done. But basically, he's not wearing a suit. He's bloody. And his mom's yelling at him. And he just, a little while ago, broke down crying because his ex-girlfriend got killed. I like your point that all the characters are broken by the end.
That's right. Yeah, it's crazy. They're stripped down to this primal version of themselves.
Yes.
So much so that even, you know, at the very end, Melanie.
Yes.
This woman is just like, a catatonic shell of herself, right? She's almost stripped down to, in some ways, her very essence, even though we don't know what that is, right? And I can only say that confidently because at the end, when she's embraced by the mother and she's in the back of the car and, you know, they're in this safety and about to drive off, she has that moment where she kind of like looks up and is like, and recognizes something in her, you know, something like, oh, almost like a child again. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I'm back in my mother's arms.
Right.
It's very simple. It is this unraveling of this societal polish to this simple, beautiful expression of just being embraced.
I think, okay, so as each character breaks down, like Mitch is still strong.
Yes.
Like he cries, but he's still heroic because he's saving his family.
Right.
Punching
birds left and right.
Yeah, he's boxing them.
He literally is punching them, right?
He should get a slingshot. Just get a slingshot.
That would be
cool. A bunch of 10-year-olds. Give them slingshots. That'll be the ultimate army against invading birds. But so when that breakdown happens, he's still actually quite strong. He's quite brave. He's a protector of his family. That's who he is.
Yeah.
Kathy, again, she cries. She's scared, but she's just a normal kid.
Right.
She's just really, really scared, but she's fine. She's still basically the same person. Very loving, very caring,
Anne was Mitch's former girlfriend. He she cries when she dies.
Right.
So you see that from her. I just find that interesting how when Melanie is broken down, she's just catatonic. She's nothing.
Yeah.
She's just blank and a mummy.
Yeah. It's scary.
I just find that interesting.
It's freaky. It's freaky because, like, she's almost not a person.
Yeah.
But still there.
Do you think that says something about her?
I mean, yeah. I think, again, part of it, like, you know, the more ambitious side of me wants to think that, well, let me say this, that when it's freaky when she goes into that catatonic state, that this really traumatic episode with the birds in that one room is like almost, it's like, well, what I mean to say is that episode is very traumatic. And so it almost like psychologically shuts off the part of her. And so, yeah, to me, I guess it all speaking to this, like, what is actually beneath that facade,
right,
is not that deep.
Exactly. Right? That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah.
When it comes to that, when you break down each character, okay. And it goes back to the mother character. Okay. She's the first one to break down.
Right.
She's the first one to see the first dead person whose eyes are pecked out. She sees her son and daughter being taken away by some other woman.
Yeah.
And she's the first one to break down and not like anything to go on. But she's the one who holds Ms. Daniels in her catatonic state. Yeah. And then she's catatonic, no emotion, just kind of empty. I think that says about her. Yeah. Maybe through her social life. That's what I think.
No, it's a good point.
You get that. And then when the end of the movie, when they're in the back of the seat, and the moment you get a reaction from Ms. Daniels is when she looks up at the mother.
Yeah.
And I think that says something.
That's true.
So I think you're right. Like, I think there's not much there just because of her lifestyle.
Right.
But the first person to break down the mother is the first person to bring someone else up.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I think.
Holy moly, that's crazy. Yeah, because even when the mother, when the mother's like breaks after they've boarded up the house and there's that wave of birds, she goes off on Mitch being like, oh, if your father was here, he would, you know, and she catches herself and she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, she apologizes and she like comes back to like that motherly core. Mm-hmm. You know, again, if we were to follow this thought of unraveling, it, you know, when she unravels, oh, there's still a loving motherly core there.
Right.
Right. So in a way, when we're going back to that scene of her in the back of the seat, her being that motherly core still holding and embracing this rather empty vessel.
Right.
It's like, oh, it's almost like this cycle of rebirth for this one person, right? Mediated through this mother who will always be a mother.
I think going to the point, I think this is a family drama.
Yeah.
I think this is a family drama, and it's kind of like scary birds are put in.
Yeah.
You know, like at the moment when they need to, like, look at this, put out a bird attack, right?
That's so
and
true.
And not only that, it's not like Alfred Hitchcock just puts it in. He knows how to build up the tension that leads up to each attack.
Yes.
So he knows what he's doing. But I think he made a family drama with these devilish birds.
Yeah.
Have you seen the movie? Have you seen Heredity? Heredity.
No. Hereditary?
Hereditary.
No, I haven't
Hereditary?
Seen
Hereditary?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So that film, I've seen it recently. You can take away the last act of the film. It's a family drama.
Whoa.
With occultish elements to it.
Yeah.
But it's a family drama.
Oh, crazy.
So I think, also one movie that, okay. So this comes to my mind, not only for the perspective of a family drama, but the whole ending when they're barricaded in the house. Signs.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good point.
Signs. So it's a family. Okay, so aliens are coming in. It's focused on one family. It's not the world. It's not the world going crazy. It's one family trying to survive while they're being attacked by aliens.
Right.
And at the end of the film, they're barricading themselves in a house with the invaders, whatever the evil might be, trying to get in.
Mm, yeah, good point.
That's what I see similarities.
Yeah, you're so right. And like, somehow, in all of that, like, Hitchcock still has you, you know? Right. He still has you intrigued. He has you excited. He has you feeling naughty. He has you feeling, questioning their characters. He uses the birds to undo these, you know, societal masks on these characters, if you will. Yeah,
yes.
And, you know, he's not pointing to what they should be or what they are, just that they'll ride off into the sun, you know? They'll ride off into the sun as a family unit, and they can build from there, right? Right,
it's like a new beginning. They're forced into a new beginning.
Yeah, and so, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I can't help but go back to the thought of, like, you know, yeah, you're so right. It is a family drama in the context of this, like, bird horror film. And you were even mentioning as we were watching, it's like, we kind of have to touch base on how, like, how kind of campy the birds are.
Yeah. You know,
and how cheesy they look. And
they didn't age well.
No, you know what? And I would, you know, argue that even at the time, they're not that horrific. You know, yeah. Like, when you see that Melanie go try to save a kid who's, like, face down, just across a fence, and the bird's, like, pecking at her, and you're supposed, like, that's not horrific, right? I think even at the time, that's not like, oh my God, like.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. I don't know. Maybe I could be off,
right?
I don't feel that.
No.
There are moments, because you know what? I say that with confidence, because there are moments in here that are genuinely horrific, that are tense, you know, like, we're like, oh God, like the moment, I mean, even when, you know, goes into the, like, almost any empty house has that feeling.
Yeah.
Right, of like, oh, what's gonna happen? What's there? It's there and it's present. But even when there's campy birds killing people, and I only bring that up to say, like, you know, what an achievement to still have this effective, deep and layered, emotional and strong, visual story about family. Right, and again, not to like pick on other films, but like that's. That is not only just mastery of cinema, but that's like, it also shows the potential of cinema. Like how much more would all of those other films that rely on these, you know, kind of tropes, how much more would they be if people try to take on challenges like this?
Yeah, like
right?
More of an emotional way of connecting with the audience.
Yes.
I think, right? Because there's a lot of characters in that film that a lot of people can relate to. Like, there's a lot of families that have lost loved ones, and then now they have to take on new responsibilities. And then someone comes in, this feeling of abandonment and other things. And I think that's what the core of the film is.
Yeah, it's very good. Very well put.
With Angry Birds.
Angry Birds. Is the game Angry Birds influenced by this?
Of course.
Maybe this film influences more than we know or give it credit for.
Probably.
Whoa.
An old film. It's a good movie.
It's nuts. Okay, well, I mean, yeah. I don't know. Is there any kind of like last topic or last thing we wanted to say about the film itself, about just your own experience about it, or about maybe how it fits into films in a larger context?
Yeah, no, like as we were discussing throughout, I think this film has a lot of influence on modern horror films. Like the fact that there's a small town and some invader comes in. The fact that there's an ending where the kind of family barricades themselves and are kind of forced to confront their family issues.
Right, yeah.
And no, it reminds me a lot of the movie Signs, where they barricade themselves and the alien's trying to get in, so they have to force it out. And then that's when we have the scene where the son is having an asthma attack.
Right.
And Mel Gibson is trying to help him breathe, and that's when you have the flashback of how he lost his faith.
Right
because he was I forget, a pastor or something.
Yeah,
right. So he lost his faith, and then he's forced to confront that finally, and by that confrontation it helps him kind of restart over again.
That's right.
So that's similar to how this film is done, when they finally barricade themselves in the house and they're forced to confront the enemy, they're forced to confront themselves. That's when all the yelling happens. That's when the mom really goes off on Mitch.
Right.
So if you want to look at the ending, I like the fact that, okay, they confront themselves. Miss Daniels is catatonic, and they leave, and all the birds are there.
Yeah.
They're all there.
But they're not attacking.
Not attacking.
Whoa.
Okay, something I adore about certain horror films. You saw that. I see that in the movie Us as well. It's this, okay, this ending. You see in Rosemary's Baby, this ending that is ambiguous and doesn't leave the audience with a concrete ending to the horror.
Yes.
It's an ongoing, lingering issue.
Right.
After the movie ends.
Right.
That leaves the audience wondering what's going to go on. It's the horror keeps going. And that's what you see at the, from this film. Because the birds attack, then they're calm. They attack, then they're calm. And when they leave and the ending of the film happens, they're calm. But is there going to be another attack after? Have they stopped? Have they figured something out? We don't know.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, we get glimpses. I mean, the birds are like, At Mitch, when he goes out the first time, they're pecking at him, you know, at his hand, at his feet, like warning signs, like, oh, tread lightly, you know?
Right.
Like it seems like whatever caused them to go attack, again, this implication of like the fake versions of them.
Okay.
Will. It's like, oh, it's like just making sure, like, hey.
Be careful.
Yeah, be careful where you step. Watch where you're going. Because you can easily just get back to that. Right?
Okay.
It's kind of cool. Like, I don't know. That's just what it says. That's right. Yeah. We'll always be here. There's no solution to us because we're the birds.
Yeah.
But we can come back whenever we want. But, like, you know, watch out. Watch your step. It's very interesting.
I want to make this point. Like, there's a film like this reminds me of that wasn't well received in a way. Have you seen The Happening?
Yes. With Mark Wahlberg?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Fuck that movie. No, I'm just kidding.
So, but same thing. So, it's kind of like a family type unit. Whether he's with his fiance or something, right?
Yeah.
And then nature itself starts attacking inexplicably. Like, there's no reason for it.
Right.
So, they're forced to stay indoors.
Yeah.
Because then plants would cause them to commit suicide.
Right.
I think that's kind of... I don't want to say a modern retelling, but it's kind of a version of nature attacking humans again, kind of like this, kind of this kind of campy way. It takes a lot of place in daylight as well.
True.
Right, and then at the end of the film, they're kind of stuck in these houses and they're forced to confront each other. If you remember the end of the film, and they kind of go, you don't need to watch it again. So I think Mark Wahlberg and his fiance are different buildings, and they're talking, communicating through piping, and they're forced to confront each other through various means, and they just forget it, screw it, and just go out and face the enemy, and the plants have stopped making people commit suicide.
Right.
So I see the similarities with this film, where they say we're just gonna go.
Yeah.
And you have this lingering feeling of anxiousness, like, are they gonna attack or are they not gonna attack? But the point I'm trying to make is, this is how you do it well.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Because it can't be. They're both like, okay, birds flying from the air, attacking, pecking people's eyes out. Right?
Yeah.
But you have this tension.
Definitely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, those are super, super good points about how it fits into other films, how it's influenced other films, how it ends. I don't have much more to like add to that. You know, I think it is an interesting portrait of like the existential crises of family unraveling and what it, not even what it should be, but like what it takes to get rid of that, you know, this very external, otherworldly, almost supernatural bird event, you know?
I think this film's a good example of what to watch in order to use craftsmanship to make certain good film elements.
Yes.
Like how to build attention. I think that's how you're supposed to do it. A good study of how you do certain horror elements.
Yeah. Again, I don't have much more to add to that. I wanted, and I just kind of went to this final frame here of the let's call them the proto family. They've been stripped away from, they've been stripped away from their personas. And they've gone through this horrific event, in the back seat, we have the mother embracing the kind of newborn Melanie, if you will. The father having gone through, you know, being steadfast and protecting everyone to, you know, get them through this event.
Right.
What's interesting is that just how it's framed in this interior shot of the car, they're all on the right side. But on the left here, we have our young Kathy, who has just been like, you know, enduring all of this, you know, almost innocently and purely.
Right.
And she's affected by this in such a just genuine way that she really hasn't changed much throughout a lot of it, which I think is okay. It's fine because she's like, again, this pure vessel. But I was just curious about, I don't even know why, I didn't even realize the first time that they have the birdcage in the car with two lovebirds. Now, I don't know if that's symbolic of, okay, the lovebird relationship, the token that Melanie wanted to give Mitch, you know, and that, oh, that's worth carrying on, that is in this new foreign family, whatever it's going to be. Or is it a bit of like a sinister nod saying that, oh, that is a reminder that the very birds that undid you are always present. They're always going to be there, even if you cover them. You kind of take them along with you in some way.
So you're saying like the qualities that they had that were stripped away from them are still with them.
Right. Like there is still the potential build that facade back up.
Miss Danis can just go back to being a socialite.
Right.
And the mom can go back to feeling abandoned.
Exactly,
and
right?
Mitch can just put on the suit again, just like...
Yes. And it's interesting that the young girl is the one who holds that. The young girl, if you look back to where she grabs it walking out of the house, she leans over to the side of the house and grabs it. She has gone out of her way to grab it. Okay. Everyone else was just making their way out of the house.
Right.
She, the young, innocent one, is almost the one that's like, oh, hey, we have to still take our baggage, almost, right?
Right.
And I don't know. I don't know that that's like a concrete Hitchcock saying, oh, we're all just going to fall into the same cycle again. I don't think it's meant to be direct. I think it's meant to be like, hey, don't forget about that.
Right.
Because you can always go back to that. Right. Humans are not a movie, you know? This is a movie, but humans are not. And they can go back to their ways.
There's a very risky tendency, I think, for habits to die hard.
Yeah.
And like you can easily go back to them, especially when you know it and you're comfortable with it.
Yeah.
You're starting something, in this case, a new life. You're starting something really difficult. It's really easy to go back to something that's really easy. And like you said, Kathy's always been the same way.
She's
very nice, very sweet, caring for everybody. So she's caring like I've never changed.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else changed.
Right.
So don't forget about these birds because they're always there.
They're always there, watching,
waiting,
pooping
to peck your eyes out.
Just get bread. I think that's just have bread with you at all times. That's what this film is trying to say.
They were just hungry.
They just wanted bread, right? Or chips or fries.
Maybe they passed a law that said no more feeding the birds. Yeah. Like everybody's like feeding these birds and you stop feeding them, they're going to be pissed. You'd be angry.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, my friend, that was great. You're good at this.
I don't like you lying to me. I can tell when you're lying because you stare into someone's eyes without blinking. And that's why I'm lying. It's your tell.
Okay, I'm going to not blink. No, I have to blink? Yeah, that's what you're saying. I have to blink. Okay, here we go. Blinking. You've been great, man. Thank you. This is good. No, your insight is awesome.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to watch that film with you.
Yeah, honestly, a lot of your insight and just the way things flowed was super good. I think I might have you back on for some more. Like, I want to pick your brains about other films is pretty much what it comes down to.
I want to be on.
I might have to get you to sign a contract and we'll talk about what payments will be.
Yeah, that's good.
That will only pay you in chips.
And
this and that's our perfect segue to our sponsor. Great Value Sour Cream and Onion Chips. Get it at your local Walmart for $1.
They're the sourest.
We're not sponsored by them, but hey, here's hoping that we will be soon. Yeah. All right, there you go. So yeah, go get your chips. Maybe that'll help us with the birds in our lives.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Well, thank you for having me.
No problem, man. Okay. And with that, we will sign off. So thank you to our viewers, to our listeners. We appreciate you on this journey. Please go watch The Birds if you have not seen it. Or if you have, and it's been a while, time to go back and dig a little deeper. Cool. Night. Have a good day, guys. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Cool.